Welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'm calling in by phone from the East Coast. And following Friday's delivery of the Mueller report to the Attorney General, who, along with the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, and staff, have been examining its findings for most of Saturday and today, Sunday, we will discuss both the legal and political landscape ahead and look into whether there will be more indictments and referrals in spite of the statement from a senior Department of Justice official that Mueller will not be issuing any more indictments. And on the political front, we will assess whether the Democrats overplayed their hand as they did in the Kavanaugh hearings, and that Trump will benefit from the backlash and be harder to beat in 2020. Although he is not doing a victory lap at this moment and has been uncharacteristically silent. Joining us will be Scott Horton, Professor of Law at Columbia and contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, and Nina Burley, the national correspondent for Newsweek and author of Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. And then we'll be joined by David Wallace Wells, deputy editor of New York Magazine and the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. He joins us for a stark assessment of global warming's effects on human life over the coming decades. And we will discuss how significant an impact the relatively short window of the past 30 years since Bill McKibben and Al Gore alerted us about the threat to life on this planet that global warming poses. He describes a scenario and presents a grim vision of what life could be like in the not-too-distant future on our endangered Earth if immediate actions are not taken. And while the U.S. is the only country on Earth where global warming denial is holding up progress, our growing awareness of the need to address this issue still does not begin to catch up to the scope of the catastrophe global warming presents. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor of law at Columbia and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. And we're waiting to hear from Nina Burley, who will also be joining us. She's a national correspondent for Newsweek and the author of Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. And Scott Horton, obviously, William Barr and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and their staff have been working on looking over this report that was delivered on Friday, although there's some rumors to the effect that maybe Barr was told about it earlier. But nevertheless, they've been looking at it, and through today, there's some talk that there will be a statement later today on Sunday. Do you think that, in spite of what the DOJ spokespeople have said, that there are no more indictments from Mueller, there still could be other indictments and referrals from other jurisdictions? Do you think that's what's happening here?
Well, it's very difficult to say, absolutely. But I think what we know is that with the submission of the report, assuming that this is the final report and there are no further reports to come, which I think is correct, although that's not entirely certain, that the Mueller team would be winding down. It would be carrying on to conclusion the cases it's already opened up. But any new matters would be coming from other U.S. attorneys' offices, not from the special counsel's office. And you've got to keep in mind that Mueller was appointed because of special circumstances surrounding Jeff Sessions that mandated the appointment of a special counsel to manage the case. And Sessions is gone, as are several other people who were potentially conflicted in the matter. So there's really no compelling reason at the moment why new things coming up wouldn't be handled by a U.S. attorney. Of course, it would depend on the facts of each individual case. But that would be the presumption that, you know, new matters handled by career prosecutors in the district that has the closest relationship to the matter.
So, in other words, when the DOJ official said that there'll be no more indictments from Mueller, that's not to say there are no more indictments or referrals.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And, you know, this is the end of the Mueller investigation. both the counterintelligence and the so-called Russiagate or collusion investigation. Of course, we know that there are a number of other investigations that are ongoing, many of which have some relationship to those, and those would continue and may also produce charges.
So do you think that Trump has been clever, in effect, to keep repeating over and over again, no collusion, no collusion, even though collusion is not a legal term, a conspiracy might be more appropriate, but nevertheless, that's been his mantra, and already people are celebrating, although Trump himself has been uncharacteristically silent.
Well, we have, I mean, we have an awful lot of people instantly after the report was pointed, deposited, taking to the airwaves and doing social media posts, declaring victory in some regard or another, suggesting that they know with absolute certainty what the report has concluded, which strikes me as rather amazing. I mean, I think we have to wait and see what the report concludes. So it's true that there are no further charges that he's brought. We don't know, however, what he found or what he concluded, and we don't know why it is he sought no further charges, including charges against Trump. And, you know, if, for instance, that conclusion rests on existing Department of Justice policy that there can't be charges preferred against him while he's serving in office, that would not be much of a basis for cries of victory. So I think we really have to see on the collusion, or let's say on what is, I think, in essence, a counterintelligence investigation, we really have to see what he found and what he concluded. And it could well be that he concluded that there's no criminal charge to be brought. In part, of course, collusion is not a crime per se. You would have to put that in other terms. But he may have made counterintelligence conclusions about conduct of Trump, which is harmful to the national security of the United States, or areas where the national security interests of the country have been breached by conduct of Trump and his staff. And he may lay that out in a great deal of detail. And all that would be, I think, hugely significant. But significant more than anything else for purposes of congressional oversight.
Right, but heavily redacted, which is one of the problems that the counterintelligence material will be redacted along with grand jury material. But my sense is that people think it's so black and white, and that, you know, suddenly no collusion means that there's no collusion because Mueller hasn't indicted him. First of all, it's incredibly difficult. Espionage cases are very difficult to prove, and these kind of conspiracy or counterintelligence cases are difficult to prove. And frankly, you know, it's pretty clear to me, having done quite a lot of research on this story of Trump and the Russians, that Trump was never a spy. He didn't go to dead drops and get his instructions from the Kremlin. He's what the KGB and the successor agents call a trusted contact, like Armand Hammer, like Carl Sagan. You know, he's somebody that they could rely on. And so much of his money came from Russia, and Russia is a checkered state, a security state, where Putin regulates the oligarchs, who were all used as cutouts to interact with Trump. And, you know, even the oligarchs have the Siloviki, the Putin security guys, literally sitting out their doors. So that is the nature of the state. And the KGB or SVR and FSB, they don't leave their fingerprints. So I think it's very naive that people think somehow that because Mueller didn't indict him, that somehow he's not compromised by the Russians.
I think that's right. So I think to start with, if you look at the Espionage Act of 1916, so there's very specific categories of conduct that are covered by that act and that provide a basis for charge. And I really don't see anywhere in the facts that we know that have come into the public sector about this where the basis for an espionage claim exists. So And you know, espionage would be like something like taking state secrets surrounding, say, military movements or equipment or sometimes highly classified policy documents. So if these things were taken and turned over to a hostile foreign power, that would be a violation of the Espionage Act. But there's no allegation of that occurring at any point here, nor any of the other categories, the sorts of intercepts that are covered, or technology that's highly sensitive being traded. No, what we're talking about here is a long course of dealings over time that were designed to secure influence over Trump by supporting him financially. And, you know, if you look at that whole history and all these allegations, it's very, very difficult to find things there. It may be scandalous, it may be shocking, but it's actually not a crime. So the closest areas you come to things that are criminal are, one, you know, failure to register as a foreign agent if you're actually representing the interests of a foreign power. And, of course, we've seen several cases where that has been tried. And secondly, election law manipulation, where you say there was a campaign or effort by foreign powers, which here could be Russia, but also could be several other foreign powers like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, for instance, to influence our elections by money or in-kind contributions. And this is what I think the investigation was heavily focused upon. And there, it's not enough to be able to prove that these foreign powers were engaged in an operation to influence the elections. You have to show that Trump and his campaign knew about it, and that there was some level, and that they knew about it by ways beyond just what they read in the newspapers or public accounts, and that they were in some way actually acting with it. There was some sort of trade-off of information or signals being given as to timing of information dumps or activities to allow him to leverage. So I think that was the real focus of the investigation. And, you know, we don't know what's finally concluded there.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Thornton, who's a professor of law at Columbia and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, and Nina Burley, who's the national correspondent for Newsweek and author of Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women, is joining us. Nina, let me ask you about the political fallout from what we know so far about the Mueller report that was delivered over the weekend, and they're still looking at it apparently today, both the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and their staff. Do you think that, as the Republicans are charging, that the Democrats overplayed their hand, as they did in the Kavanaugh hearings, and that Trump will benefit from the backlash and be harder to beat in 2020?
Well, it's hard to tell. You know, there's a lot can happen between now and 2020, so I can't answer how it's going to affect that. I mean, I think it's not looking good for anyone who hitched their cart or approach to Trump via the espionage concept, which I believe your other guest was just referring to. It's always been, to me, it always seemed like it was a slightly problematic avenue to take politically to make Trump's election the product of Russian activity. I've always said the United States, the electorate, and the system here was perfectly capable of doing, of creating a Trump presidency without Russian assistance. Now, I get pushback on that because if you look at their, you know, the targeted ads that they were working on, and the trolls, and all of the things that were going on during that campaign, and then looked at the states where his margins were so thin, you know, that you can say, well, the Russians did that. But, you know, Hillary Clinton also did that by not visiting some of the states. And, you know, the ground was already fertile in the United States for a revolution of some kind. It was either going to be a Bernie revolution or a Trump revolution. And so I think politically, the blame the Russians for Trump angle was pretty much a bad call. I think that this investigation, we don't know what it says yet, what the Mueller report says yet, but I think I've always thought that whatever is in it isn't going to be surprising, because the journalism that's been done and the reporting and the biographies of Trump that have been written already sort of indicate, you know, the New York tycoon wasn't a tycoon, the Russian oligarchy pouring money into his buildings to wash it, the misogyny, the sexual assault allegations, the hush money, that are, those are FEC violations, crimes. All of this criminal stuff was already reported on. So it's hard for me to imagine what is going to be in this report that we don't already know about. I think the problem always was going to be whether they could make any kind of case against him legally, you know, whether our law is up to a Trump. And I've written about that as well. Is the law, is the American law up to a Trump? I mean, right. He was in New York for 20, 30 years, you know, practicing his business in ways that we now, that have now been exposed as, you know, money laundering and you know, other tax issues that may or may not be illegal or quasi-legal. And he got away with it for years and years. The feds, the FBI, was wiring up Trump Tower and perp walking Russian mobsters out of the building just a couple of floors down from him. So, I mean, these things are going on and nobody did anything. The New York FBI wasn't able to catch up to him. So, why is it that we all of a sudden think, you know, the 22 months of, FBI, former FBI head looking into all this could make a case? We don't know what it says, and he may have been able to make a case, but the president is unindictable under our law. So it's hard to tell. I don't know. I think the fallout in the short term is not good. You know, you see the Matt Taibbi article today blaming the media. You know, this is he's calling Russia. It's Russiagate is the WMD of this generation's journalism. That journalists fell for this line of attack on Trump. And maybe that's true. I think he's going a little far with it. But again, I think that the 2020 election, a long ways off, and, you know, it may, this problem of how the law deals with Trump will considerably play out more in the Southern District of Manhattan and other places before that time rolls around.
So Scott Horton, let me have you comment on what Nino said.
Well, let me just say to start with, it's absolutely not the case that the law says the president's unindictable. So the president can be indicted at any time by a state. And the only prohibition on indictments of the president that exists in the federal system is what is effectively a traffic rule that's issued by the Department of Justice that came in an opinion in 1973 in the context of the investigation into Spiro Agnew, and that the Department of Justice itself, a couple of years later in a submission to the Supreme Court, said, well, that might have been written just for this trip only, so not generally. Nevertheless, we know that that Barr, the Attorney General, believes that there can be no indictment of a sitting president. I think he may have acknowledged that there might be some flexibility in it somewhere, but he seemed to be pretty extreme on that view. So that's the problem. I think we also have to note that, you know, it was not Bob Mueller's responsibility here to investigate whether the Russians threw the election or anything of that sort. I mean, that is not his responsibility. That would not be the subject of a proper legal inquiry anyway. In our system, there are no do-overs or going back or anything like that. Once the election is certified and handed in, that's it. But it was his responsibility to look into, look on sort of two levels. One was on a counterintelligence level to find out whether activities were going on that were harmful to the United States, and whether these activities involved members of the president's campaign staff and his staff more broadly. It's quite clear from his action that investigation hit pay dirt on several different scores and resulted in criminal claims, but we don't know the entire sum of what he learned. And it's very unlikely that Barr is going to tell us anything about that. So I think what Barr is going to do is probably just give us the caps of the waves on determinations about criminal charges in different areas. And it's probably going to be hard going even to understand the legal rationale and reasons for these decisions. So, and that's the case if we look at prior special counsel's report, the Department of Justice has never covered itself in glory in explaining or letting the public know what the special counsel found in his investigation. But I think this means that we're being thrown into a new political process. 2020 is a long ways away. Who knows what's going to happen by then? But I think what this is going to do is play into investigations that are already running in the Congress, and particularly in the House of Representatives. And I think that's what Adam Schiff in particular is going to be fishing for. And I think Adam Schiff himself has already made very, very clear he's much more interested in what the counterintelligence investigation concluded and the facts it found and the evidence it uncovered. And I think pretty clear that that would be used as the basis for new investigations by congressional committees.
So, Nina Burley, you mentioned that Trump's career in New York of being one step ahead of the sheriff. And, of course, Michael Cohen said in his public testimony to Congress that throughout the campaign, Trump kept saying this is the greatest infomercial for the Trump Organization. To your mind, was he really not prepared to be president, didn't think he was going to be president, and suddenly he finds himself in the world's biggest goldfish bowl? And clearly, since the special counsel Mueller referred Michael Cohen to the Southern District of New York, isn't it possible that there'll be other referrals coming from Mueller? Because what the DOJ spokesman said was there'll be no more indictments from Mueller himself, but that's not to say that there are no more indictments and referrals.
Well, two questions or more. The fitness for the presidency Trump's desire to actually be president, his understanding of what that meant when he started running. I'm not one of these people who thinks he didn't want to be president. Maybe he didn't think he was going to win, but I think he wanted to be. And I think that he has been schooled all the way back to, at his father's knee on doing business in this sort of quasi-legal way. Or more accurately, I guess, just to say that the Trump family and a lot of very wealthy, wealthy people like Epstein do reasonably believe that they are above the law or that the rules don't apply to them. So when he's running for president and all of a sudden he's in the spotlight and all of his business dealings are now going to be inspected, he doesn't think that they're illegal. He doesn't believe that. You know, his lawyers have worked it out for him for years that he's getting away with this stuff, like his other friends. And that's how the system works. And that's he believed that he, and probably still does believe, that he's just doing things the way things are always done. This is the way business gets done. So I don't think that he was worried that he was going to be exposed. Now, to the indictment question, yes, I know that, Mr. Horton, I know that there are two sides to that. I mean, you can look it up, and you've got one side, and you've got the other side. But I think that the idea that Mueller did not think that he could indict the president is probably going to come through here. But I don't know. It's always been a political issue, really. At the end of the day, Trump is a political issue. It's going to be. You talk to people about whether the law can catch up to him or not. The real issue is, can the American people muster the will to vote him out of office? The American people voted him in, and can they vote him out? It's a political question. It was always going to be a political question. The people who thought that Mueller could save them from that were wrong.
So in effect, you could say that those that were invested in the magic bullet getting rid of the president they hate, they're going to be disappointed. And do you think those that believe that this is all a deep state coup, are they also going to be disappointed? Quickly from Nina and then from Scott.
Are the deep state coup people going to be disappointed that Mueller didn't carry out the deep state coup? No, they're perfectly
happy. Well, in other words, are the findings such that if there are more to come, will the findings disappoint both sides, in other words? We know that so far the people who expected a magic bullet to get rid of Trump will be disappointed so far.
Well, certainly they're going to be disappointed. They're already disappointed because there are no indictments. And
Right. They're
going to be disappointed if nobody gets to see what's in it. Presumably he went through a lot of the information that we already know about the money laundering and so on. Maybe he has his taxes. I don't know. But how much of that stuff is going to come out? Is Barr going to open it up? How much of it is now, you know, a matter of national security? Hard to tell. I mean, he's definitely somebody who's managed to skate for a long time. And I don't know. I don't think that it's, again, I don't think it's the law that's going to catch up to him. I think that also these congressional committees, you know, it's going to be great when they get a lot of people testifying in public. But going back to the Bush administration, you know, with the Iraq War and the 22 lost emails that Cheney supposedly lost having to do with the start of the Iraq War, the subpoenas from the Senate Judiciary Committee had no effect. I mean, they were in contempt of court when Bush lost, or sorry, when Obama was elected. Those emails were still hidden, and the Bush administration had just blown off subpoena after subpoena. So if Trump's passed his prologue, they'll operate the same way.
A quick last word from Scott Horton. Do you think disappointment on both sides here?
Oh, I think certainly that's the case. But I think there were also unreasonable expectations on both sides. I mean, you know, anyone who thought this was going to be a silver bullet that would just take down Trump, I mean, I think that was a very, very marginal possibility. And with respect to the deep state, you know, of course, that theory was developed principally looking at Turkey. It was applied to Pakistan, a few other countries over time. We've got a few social scientists, political scientists, who thought that that theory might be applied to the United States to some extent. But if you go back and you look at the way they've done it when they've compared the situation in the United States to that in Turkey, what everyone's concluded is that if we have a deep state, we have a deep state that's built around the president and protecting and enhancing the power and authority of the president. And I think we're seeing that in how all of this plays out, because the system really is rigged to protect the president all the way through. And there's no greater master of that process, actually, than Attorney General Barr. And I think that's going to be the center of the struggle for the next couple of months. And that struggle is going to be over getting out the actual factual conclusions of this investigation, which I predict Barr will work overtime to thwart.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Scott Horton, again, professor of law at Columbia, junior editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, and Nina Burley, national correspondent for Newsweek and the author of Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with the author of the new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, which I recorded a couple of days ago.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
He said, "Fear me again. No, I'm your father. Remember that no one can breathe underwater." So bend your knees and bow your heads. Save your babies, here's your future. Yeah, here's your future.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Wallace Wells, a national fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review. And his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Wallace Wells.
Thanks for having me.
And David, this is Sunday, and I'm on tape. Well, we're on tape, I should say. I'm visiting my three-year-old granddaughter on the East Coast, and your book suggests that by the time she's about 30 years old, the Earth is going to be a pretty horrible place to live, and that really stabs at my heart. And one of the people, or the many people who endorsed your book, Tim Snyder, the historian at Yale, said, "If we don't want our grandchildren to curse us, we'd better read this book." So you've put me on notice.
Yeah, I think things are likely to get considerably worse in the quite immediate future. I think that for a long time, we were generally speaking mistaken in believing that climate change was arriving quite slowly and we could have several generations to figure our way around it or out of it. In fact, half of all of the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels have come in just the last 30 years, which means we've brought ourselves basically from a stable climate to one where we're on the brink of real catastrophic suffering in just that amount of time, just 30 years, and the next 30 are going to be just as consequential. We will really be shaping the future of human life on this planet over these next couple of decades, and we will be seeing the impacts of exactly how we're doing on that metric in something like real time. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, however horrible climate change could get, and it will probably get quite bad and is, you know, can conceivably get really dramatically bad. The scale of those impacts, the scale of that possible suffering is really a reflection of the power that we retain over the climate. If we get to, say, 3 or 4 degrees of warming this century, that will be because of actions we take from here on out, and our hands are always going to be on those levers. Human inputs are always going to be the most important driver of future climate change. And so, as overwhelming, as horrifying as it can be to contemplate some of these outcomes, I think they're also a reminder that everything is within our power, and if we choose to avoid them and choose to commit to avoiding them, we can.
But given what you just said about how much damage has been done in the last 30 years, in this last 30 years, it was about 30 years ago that Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature. And then subsequently, of course, Al Gore made those two films warning us about climate change. So what's happening there? Why is it that this can't penetrate our consciousness? How much more evidence do we need?
I'm not sure it's a matter of evidence, but I think that the signs are actually relatively encouraging about public opinion, public polling. The support for action is much more widespread than it was just a few years ago, and I think that that's all room for encouragement. In the U.S., 73% of Americans believe in climate change, believe it's happening. 70% of them are concerned about it. Those numbers are up about 15% since 2015. They're up about 8% since March. That's really fast movement by any political science measure. The problem is it's not fast enough when you look at the timeline of action that we need to avoid really terrible warming. And as you point out, our recent record, our recent history suggests that, you know, the more we know, it has almost no effect on how we act. All of this damage that we've done has been done, you know, since Bill McKibben published his book, since Al Gore published his book, since the UN established the IPCC. And over that time, we've had great progress on technology. Our renewable energy has gotten a lot cheaper. And yet, the proportion of clean energy to dirty energy hasn't grown at all. So we've responded to innovations, inventions, and market progress, not by retiring dirty energy sources and reducing our carbon footprint globally, but by simply adding energy capacity to our, you know, to the problem. You know, as for how that makes you feel going forward, you know, it's not the most hope-giving, optimistic situation that we find ourselves in. We've done all of this damage to ourselves very quickly, and there's very little reason to think that we will change course. But as I say, it's possible. It's not baked in. And I think that's important to remember. If, you know, some deniers will say, well, this is, you know, these are just natural cycles. We're not seeing warming that's the result of human action. We're seeing the result of warming that's coming out of the climate directly. And first of all, that's sort of bunk science. But second of all, if that were the case, it should terrify us so much more. It should be a kind of a comfort that we retain control over the system, even if we've shown so little willingness to really change. As for why we've shown so little willingness to change, I think it's a quite complicated question. And I think there are a lot of factors, you know, ranging from the forces of political inaction, fossil fuel money, and that kind of thing, all the way down to the individual level, where even people who are quite concerned about the issue are not all that focused on it, don't organize their lives around it, don't even organize their politics around it. And I think ultimately that's the sort of global problem that we're dealing with, because, you know, there isn't anywhere else in the world like the U.S. that has climate denial in it. There's no other country in the world that has a party as resistant to action on climate as the U.S. has. Many countries in the world are much more green in their political rhetoric than we are. And yet, basically no country of the world is behaving responsibly when it comes to carbon. No major industrial nation in the world is on track to meet its commitments under Paris. And given how universal that bad behavior is, I think we have to look at ourselves and our own biases and our own psychological reflexes, our own emotional reflexes, to really answer the question of why we haven't acted, all of which I think push us away from looking squarely at the science and taking it seriously, and instead encourage us to live through compartmentalization and denial about the issue, because we don't want to stare in the face of the threat. It's too scary.
Well, clearly we have a president who's turned back the clock, and the window is closing on what time left we have to deal with global warming and the looming catastrophic results from global warming. And as we've made clear, that essentially 30 years have been lost since people warned us about this clear and present danger, which is now accelerated. I don't know what's going on with President Trump, and it's broader than him. It's the Republican Party at large. We know that the Koch brothers have a lot of influence over them. I don't know whether he's a sadist or what exactly. I mean, his daughter apparently is supposedly concerned about it, and I think she introduced both Leonardo DiCaprio and Al Gore in the transition period, but clearly they did not sway Trump. But just the other day, I was pulled into a parking lot, and next to this huge black SUV with those big tires, and it had these enormous tailpipes that shot up out of the cab, you know, into the air, like massive chimney stacks. And the car was festooned with pro-Trump stickers and Confederate flags, etc. I'd like to understand. I know it's more extreme. I think those that are indifferent are just as criminal in a sense, but those who sort of actively denied or even proudly deny climate change, which I think you could tar Trump with that brush, what's going on with them? It sort of strikes me as the same kind of pathology that somebody with lung cancer continues to smoke cigarettes, or somebody with diabetes eating tubs of ice cream.
Well, I would think those last two analogies apply to really all of us. I mean, I certainly include myself in that as well. Everything I do, everything you do, has some kind of carbon footprint, and we're neither of us, I don't know much about your life, but I can just say, generally speaking, people like us are not doing nearly enough to change that. But there is, you know, there is a group of people who, as you say, are really kind of proudly hostile to the very idea that this is a problem. And I think, you know, I think that reflects American partisan politics, that we live in an incredibly tribalized era. And if one side is really agitated about one issue, there are going to be at least some people on the other side who are excited to just thumb their nose at those people and that issue, however it might be related to their own lives, however it might affect their own lives. It's like a kind of partisan score setting, and exciting in that way to really thumb your nose at liberals who are concerned about climate change. But I think that while that is a feature of American life, it's an unfortunate feature of American life, I don't think that it's as determinative as many on the American left tend to think that it is. So if we have 73% of Americans who believe that global warming is real and happening now, that means that only 27% of Americans don't believe it. 26% of Americans believe that aliens live among us, and we don't have a politics that is distorted or deformed by that belief in the same way that we have a politics that's distorted and deformed by climate denial. You know, I think there's also the additional sort of explanatory force of fossil fuel money and the way that those forces have kind of captured the Republican Party. But again, American politics is basically the only politics in the world where one of the major parties is as in denial as the Republican Party is here, and yet nowhere in the world are people behaving more responsibly towards carbon than we are. So again, I think that we have a kind of a tendency to look for easy villains, and it's certainly the case that the Republican Party, climate deniers, and the fossil fuel business have been truly villainous on this front, but I think it's also important to understand that they are not simple explanations for the state that we're in right now. In fact, most of the reason that we're in a kind of a state of climate crisis in 2019 is because of the industrialization of the developing world. So it's action that hasn't even happened inside the U.S. or in the EU. It's been the development of China and India, and to a lesser extent, sub-Saharan Africa. Now, I think the U.S. and the EU and the U.K. have a moral responsibility to play a leadership role on climate because of the historical role that we played in creating this problem. But over the last couple of decades, and certainly going forward into the next, the climate future of the planet will be determined by those other countries much more significantly than by ours. And so while we have an obligation to kind of show the way and demonstrate that you can live prosperous, just, fulfilling lives within much smaller carbon footprints, the real story is going to be determined by some of these other nations and the decisions and paths that they take going forward.
Well, it would be great if there was a whole new paradigm that could be just completely installed, if you will, with these developing countries. Their attitude, I'm sure, is, look, you guys have been fat and happy for the longest time, and we're just starting to get a little bit of the crumbs under the table, and now you're telling us we can't have what you've had for decades?
I think that is a very pointed and helpful, incisive way of thinking about it and looking at it. Thankfully, I think there is a bit of a new paradigm being put into place because already in much of the world, not all of the world yet, but in much of the world, green energy is now cheaper than dirty energy. And I think in short order, it will be cheaper everywhere in the world. And that will mean that the remaining global poor can emerge out of global poverty into something like global middle classness without taking the same fossil fuel driven path that China has taken recently and the West took 100 years ago or so. Now, how quickly we can install new energy infrastructure in those countries and how quickly, therefore, those people can take that more responsible path, that's a little bit of an open question. Depends a lot about national politics, local politics. But in principle, I think in relatively short order, it will be the case that they can behave more responsibly without foregoing the economic growth that is obviously morally, you know, imperative that they embrace, because, as you say, so many of us in the West have benefited so enormously from the wealth created by the burning of fossil fuels. It would be criminal to deprive some of that wealth from those who are now most in need. But I think going forward, we won't need to ask them to make that choice. That's my hope anyway.
Well, when you mentioned a little while ago, David Wallace Wells, that the U.S. is the only country that has active denial, but other countries that have stayed with Paris, the Paris Accords, which, of course, Trump took the U.S. out of, are nevertheless not meeting their goals. I mean, for example, Russia's entire economy is based upon burning fossil fuels, and I don't see them changing at all. Do you?
Well, no, I think Russia is one of the countries in the world where things are going to be most complicated. But I also think that it's not too hard to imagine a new geopolitics of climate, of carbon evolving over the next decade or so that will make the community of nations much more focused on how each country is behaving with regard to carbon than they have in the past, so that exactly what you're doing on climate change could become as important for your reputation on the world stage as, say, your human rights record is today. And that could mean a future in which a nation like Russia was sanctioned, possibly even quite aggressively, for bad behavior on carbon, or possibly even something, you know, punished in some way more aggressively, say, with military action. I think that's sort of hard to imagine now, but if you had said to someone in the 1910s or 1920s that just 30 or 40 years into the future there would be wars fought in the name of human rights, I think they would have been quite surprised as well. And I think the world will be transformed by the force of climate change in exactly that kind of a way, so that several decades from now it will be impossible to think about geopolitics, to think about domestic politics, to think about economics, to think about our relationship to technology, without really first thinking about the state of the climate, because it is just that all-encompassing a system which will affect and, in most cases, damage everything about the way that we live. Now, you know, I also, at a more on a more encouraging front, see MBS, the leader of Saudi Arabia, talking about how he needs his country's economy to go entirely off oil by 2050, probably mostly off oil by 2030. And MBS is a kind of horrific figure in many, many ways and not someone you want to applaud, but that contains some real wisdom about how the world is evolving. He thinks he understands, and I hope he's right, that a decade or so down the line, a country couldn't be as dependent on oil as Saudi Arabia is today and still expect a seat at the table of nations. And what that means for the future of the world generally remains to be seen, but I think that we are moving in that direction probably quite rapidly, and we'll have to develop a kind of new politics around carbon to make sense of the new climate future that we find ourselves in, with considerably more resource scarcity, considerably larger refugee crisis, and many more challenges and threats than we can really process or imagine right now.
Let's take a brief station break, and we'll continue the conversation with David Wallace Wells about his new book just out, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warning.
At least it's not the end of the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with David Wallace Wells, who is a national fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. And he was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review. And his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. So just let's quickly go through the alternative energies. I mean, of course, the Green New Deal is getting a lot of attention. And as we mentioned earlier, Trump has turned back the clock. This has been, you know, 4 years, assuming he lasts 4 years. It's 4 years wasted, in effect. And of course, he's talked about bringing back coal, which is not necessarily happening. But coal is about as bad as it gets in terms of CO2. But natural gas has been ballyhooed as the great replacement for coal because its footprint's about a half in terms of CO2. But there's an awful lot of leakage of methane associated, particularly with fracking for natural gas. And nuclear, where it doesn't have a carbon footprint, is incredibly expensive, and nobody knows quite what to do with the radioactive waste part of it. And I don't see any clamor on Wall Street to start investing in nuclear. So would you agree with that sketch of the alternatives short of the wind and solar?
I think in general we have to probably invest some amount of money in nuclear to get those prices down. But I also think that wind and solar are quite appealing alternatives that are quite scalable and quite cheap right now. So when I look at the problem, the sort of bigger picture problem of our global carbon footprint, I don't see energy as the most problematic sector. I actually see it as the least problematic sector. I think that we probably need to do the least to get ourselves all the way to zero emissions there. And I think that market forces are sort of already driving us in that direction, even if they're not driving us there fast enough. The other sectors are more complicated. There's transportation, there's industry, there's agriculture. Each of these has is much more complicated to solve than the energy problem. And in some cases, there are interventions that can be undertaken relatively soon with existing technology. In other cases, we're ways off from that. We really don't have anything like a carbon-free plane that will be available anytime soon. And we know that the world is not about to give up air travel. So where does that leave us? We can replace some of that travel with high-speed rail, but certainly not all of it. You can't go from New York to Japan on high-speed rail. And we are quite far from having planes that can take us those distances without imposing a massive carbon impact. You know, the average round-trip flight in the U.S. from New York to Los Angeles is the equivalent of 8 months of driving, and every round-trip flight from New York to London is every seat on every flight New York to London melts about 3 square meters of Arctic ice. It's every single seat on every single one of those planes. Flying is really, you know, jet travel is only 2%, I think, of the global carbon problem, but it's growing, and we don't have an easy solution to it. Similar problems with a lot of heavy industry. Agriculture seems to me to be an area where there's some more available solutions, but even so, it's a quite thorny, complicated problem, much more thorny and more complicated than energy. And I think we really need to aggressively focus our political energy and also our R&D investments in those areas so that we can make transitions that we need to make rather than just sort of waiting for the transitions to happen by themselves.
Well, I think transportation, in terms of its contribution to CO2, in terms of the countries that are the biggest emitters, I think the US is still number one, I think China's two, is India three, I'm not sure, but I understand transportation itself, that includes aircraft and ships at sea, is about number five, isn't it?
I don't. You may be right. I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but that seems totally plausible to me.
Right. And it's a little ironic that people who care about global warming and meet at Davos also fly there in private jets, right?
Yeah. I think in general that we have an inclination, we have a kind of reflex. We hope to see a single silver bullet solution. We hope to see, oh, this kind of invention is going to save us, or this kind of policy action is going to save us. It's far too massive and far too complicated a problem to solve with just one approach, one solution. And so we're going to have to get down to quite tiny slices of the pie and focus on shrinking those slices as well, because we just won't be able to make the progress necessary in any one sector. It's going to require us to focus on all sectors, no matter how small.
So since I'm visiting my granddaughter back east, and we're on tape today, David Wallace Wells, she just turned 3. So give us a picture of what the world will look like when she's about 30 years old, which is, I take it, when you think we reach the point of no return.
Well, I think it's probably around the time when we'll be at about 2 degrees or a little north of 2 degrees of warming by mid-century. And that is if we don't take dramatic action and we kind of continue on the course we're on. It's also possible that we take some amount of action, which will mean that we'll still end up at 2 degrees or north of 2 degrees, but not as soon as 2050. So let's just talk about that temperature rise. At say, 2.5 degrees, we will have begun the irreversible melt of some of the world's biggest ice sheets, which over time, it'll take centuries, but over time could raise sea levels hundreds of feet, several hundred feet. We would have, according to the UN, at least 200 million climate refugees, possibly as many as 1 billion climate refugees. That's as many people as live in North and South America combined. We would have many cities in South Asia and the Middle East that would be literally unlivable during summer, that you couldn't go outside. You certainly couldn't work outside without risking heat stroke and possibly death. Some of these cities now house 10, 12, 15 million people, and they would be, practically speaking, uninhabitable for parts of the year. Now, we have some time to adjust to these changes. They're not going to happen overnight, and so it's not as though there's like one door is open and then suddenly it's shut and we're in a whole different world. That's not how climate works. It's not binary. It unfolds slowly over time, and we will adjust accordingly. But if we get to a place in 2050 where whole parts of the Middle East and South Asia are, practically speaking, uninhabitable, that will really have a dramatic impact on our global politics and our economies. And I don't think we can sort of walk blithely into that situation, assuming that it will work itself out. Even if it is the case that some features of it will work out, we will continue to have something like civilization. We will continue to have something like recognizable forms of modern life. But they will be so transformed by these forces that, looking at them from the vantage of today, we might not even recognize them. And that's really the sort of central subject of my book, not just what's going to happen to us, but not just what climate change is going to do, what it promises, what is coming down down the pike, what is scheduled to happen, but what it will mean for the way that we all live together on this planet, how we will organize our lives, where we will look for meaning, how we will understand ourselves in relation to nature, how we will understand ourselves in history. And I think there are some real profound changes on those fronts to come. I think it's a whole area of inquiry. I think of it as kind of the humanities of climate change that really hasn't been explored yet. And I think some of those impacts will be more profound even than the direct impacts of climate change.
So when would the ocean be lapping at the doorsteps of Mar-a-Lago down in Florida?
Yeah. Well, I think those risks are actually quite around the corner. I mean, most of South Florida is really low-lying and really vulnerable to sea level rise. I think that those lands are unlikely to be livable at some point in the second half of the century. I think it's going to require that little sea level rise. Now, there are some accommodations we can make. There are some protections we can build. We can build seawalls. We can move people off the coast because, again, it's not something that one day you're going to wake up and a whole city that was above water is suddenly underwater. But all of that infrastructure building is really expensive. And frankly, since it's happening everywhere in the world, it will require prioritization and sort of rationing of resources. And that raises another big question, which is climate change is universal. It will affect all of us. It will affect all of our lives. But it also affects us unequally. Its impacts are distributed unequally. And unfortunately, resources will be distributed unequally, too, which means that those most in need, the global poor, the global south, are likely to be even worse off, relatively speaking, 50 years from now than they are today, because those of us living in the relatively affluent corners of the world will be able to do some things, probably a lot of things, to protect ourselves. But those people living in the equatorial band of the world, in the low-lying regions in, say, India and Bangladesh, will be able to do much less. And exactly how that opens up onto the geopolitical stage, I don't know for sure, but I would not at all be surprised if they were major calls for climate reparations and, that kind of negotiation over who owes what to whom, who will pay for what kinds of protections, and who's responsible for the immense, probably unprecedented suffering that we're likely to see over the course of the century as climate change really begins to unfold.
And, of course, what's so scary about the process of climate change is that it's self-reinforcing. It accelerates. In other words, as the more the Arctic and Antarctic ice melts, the less light is reflected back out into the atmosphere from the white snow to the dark ocean then increases. And then the tundra, of course, melts and releases more methane, which is the most pernicious of global warming gases. So that is unfortunately how it is in terms of science. It accelerates. So just in the last minute, let's talk briefly about the example you give in your book about how Syria, that country that's literally died before our eyes, is in many ways an example of what happens with global warming, because global warming did play a part in the disintegration of that country.
Yeah, the civil war that took place a few years ago in Syria was not, everybody's careful to say it was not caused in a simplistic way by climate change, but climate change was a factor because it was a drought that produced a kind of famine that led to civil unrest and war. And, you can look next door at Lebanon, they went through similar climate conditions and they didn't have a civil war. But my perspective on this is that if climate change makes some event more likely, it's sort of dismissive to say that it was not a cause. So I think it's quite fair to say that that civil war was caused by climate change to some degree. It produced a refugee crisis. 12 million people left the country. 1 million went to Europe, and that 1 million in Europe really destabilized all of European politics. I think it played a role in Brexit, and you could even say it's played a role in the election of Donald Trump because it's had such a cascading impact through our global politics. The UN says that we're likely to see a climate crisis that's at least 100, perhaps 200, perhaps 1,000 times as big as that over the next few decades. And just what that will mean for the way that we all live together I think we don't know yet, but it's clear that the impacts will be profound, and it's important for us to like look seriously at the science and think seriously about what it will mean for the way that we live together.
Well, David Wallace Wells, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Wallace Wells, who's a national fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review, and his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. Bye.